play. The kids here have distinctive, innocent faces. They are just gorgeous. And they're all wearing their traditional costumes, boys and girls alike. All wearing traditional clothes. They are among the oldest, most original tribes in Iran. They're very noble and very patient. They are a people with a lot of patience. And although some of them don't have good living conditions, they are very patient folks. They're so content. The Baluchi culture is the perfect example of a culture of nobility and peace, and those cultural traits are readily visible in the architecture of the old houses in this village. The architectural design is endemic to Baluchistan. You can't see anything like this anywhere else in Iran. There are also new houses in these areas with designs influenced by Indian and Pakistani cultures and architectures. One of the characteristics of Baluch families is their large populations. Wherever in the village I go, I'm surrounded by many of the little angels offering a breath of fresh air after a long day of hard work. They fill my heart with peace and joy. Perhaps one of the reasons these kids are so happy is their beautiful, tranquil, natural environs. Just as influential is the beautiful, happy colors used in the clothes that these little girls have on. Clothes that are embroidered by the artistic hands of their mothers. Hand embroidery on colorful clothes and fabric is among the most important crafts of Baluchi women. And fortunately, Baluchi women have been able to preserve this exquisite art, a skill handed down through generations. It's noontime. It can get really hot in Shirguaz, even in the middle of winter. But the boys of the village have a good solution to fighting the scorching heat. What they do at a time like this is jump into the waters of Shirguaz River and swim to their heart's content. These children usually play together in groups. The day offers an opportunity for me to make a return to the beautiful carefree days of my own childhood. Live life as an uninhibited, unabashed explorer of the unknown. Playing with these children serves as an outlet for the negative energy in me. Although the children in Shirguaz don't have much to entertain themselves with, they're all growing up happy, healthy, and strong by playing in groups and making the best of what their natural environment provides them with. No computers to spend the whole day on, playing virtual computer games that don't involve any physical activity, video games that have taken the place of playing outside for many kids today, outdoor experiences in nature, and plenty of physical activity that a growing body craves. These children's only toy is nature, going up trees, diving into the river and swimming, playing with animals, singing songs and helping their parents at home and on the farm, frolicking around and playing with stones and pebbles. This non-stop joyful mobility is the reason behind these children's physical health and happy disposition.
I'm
Very soon, I leave the village and set out for my next destination. I have to travel 250 kilometers to the west of Balochistan, to a place 80 kilometers north of the city of Nikshar, a name that reminds me of my country's beautiful north. Given its unique geographical location, Balochistan has a diverse and strange climate. Some parts of this area is affected by the tropical climate of India, in the south by the Sea of Oman, in the west by the Jazmuriyan Inland Basin, and in the north by Lut Desert. Surrounded by these different climatic conditions, Balochistan features diverse lifestyles and various plant and animal species. Balochistan is a dry, water-thirsty land. The average annual rainfall in the province is around 110 millimeters. But the important thing is, all that water comes down in only a couple of torrential rainfalls that cause the rivers in the province to overflow their banks. The ensuing flooding leaves behind a trail of destruction every time. The people here tell me they get snow and blizzards in some winters too, because of the mountains in the Gorgan area. Perhaps you'll find it interesting to know there is a place named Gorgan in Sistan and Balochistan province. But no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Gorgan in the north of Iran. This area is comprised of around 11 villages punctuating this mountainous area. It can get freezing cold here. The people of Balochistan say, except for Mount Taftan and Mount Basman, the only other place where you can see snow in the highlands is the same Gorgan region in Balochistan. It can get really cold here. Because of the altitude and the relatively good rainfall here, this valley usually has a good amount of water. And abundant water means life and prosperity. The people of Gorgan are either farmers or orchard owners or livestock keepers. The most important thing for them to be able to do any of those things is to have clean drinking water. The people of the first village I visit are very kind and hospitable. In my conversations with them, I realize all the young people in the village are busy working simply because there is enough water. Everyone has something to do. They're all grateful to God for all their blessings. Their biggest asset is contentment. I could say most of the things I've seen in this village were built from scratch by the men and women living here. They're all content with what they have. They even have electricity. They live a beautiful, simple, and healthy life, away from the hustle and bustle of city life and excesses that distract human beings from their true self and from nature. The Baluch community leads a simple lifestyle in their simple homes in Balochistan. They don't even expect a paved road. The peace that these lovely people exude is a breath of fresh air against the vicissitudes of city life. I am so at peace when I am in their fold. Before long, I resume my journey and arrive in the village of Archanik, a bucolic settlement second to none. But it isn't the architecture and natural environment that lends Archanik its beauty. The most beautiful thing I come across is the hospitality of the local inhabitants. Archanikis are hard-working, hospitable people. Moments after I reach the village, one of the elders comes to welcome me and invite me to his beautiful house. And the family gives me the red carpet treatment. Personally, I have a lot of respect for the culture and customs of this lovely ancient tribe and have tried my best not to have a negative impact on the culture or any of the good social norms of this community. Instead, I learned from them things that I had no idea about before I met them. I have had many trips to far and exotic places in Iran. And on those trips, I saw many and varied village houses and nomad tents. But nothing like the teeps in the Gorgan region. beautiful, modest homes that offer peace and tranquility, just like their natural surroundings. Village elder Pir Muhammad fills me in on how they build their houses. My trip is nearing its end. That means I have to leave the beautiful Sistan and Baluchistan province and head back home. I leave with a bag of experience and memories as sweet as the dates of Gorgon. And I do so knowing that I haven't done any harm to the natural environment and the culture of this ancient tribe.
Well, I'm quite sure that this week's documentary about Iran's natural wonders intrigued all our audience across the globe. And I hope it inspires you to come and explore the hidden treasures of Iran. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us. And until next week, goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Experts say indicators point to an impending economic downturn in the United States of America. Strategists warn that The U.S. recession is looming. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the U.S. is on the brink of recession, judging from its brutally bad economic data. Chris Watling, chief executive of financial advisory from Longview Economics, said in an interview with CNBC recently. According to the strategist, one of the factors pointing to a looming recession is the latest reading of the leading economic index for the U.S., which fell by 1.2% in March, its lowest level since November 2020. Furthermore, the standard timeline for a recession is about 1 year after the inversion of the Treasury yield curve, when yields on shorter-dated securities rise above those for longer-term ones. As the curve first inverted in March 2022, the economic downturn may well be just around the corner, Watling said. He was cited as saying, "Every time you've had that in the U.S., you've had a recession. So I think it's coming. It's on the way. It's just a timing issue." Just last month, the inversion intensified, reaching negative 103.1 basis points, which represented the largest gap between shorter-dated and longer-term yields since September 1981, when the American economy was in the early month of a recession. Watling also warned of the consequences for equity markets once recession hits. He explained, "They won't come through it unscathed, in our opinion. It's not even sure about relativity. The reality is, if you look at profit margins, they went to record highs in 2021 and a bit of 2022. And of course, when you have a lot of inflation around, you can get very good operating leverage, so you can get record high profit margins. When you get into recession, we've got to do a double hit on profit margins. You've got to normalize them back to normal levels, and then you've got to price in a recession." According to Watling, expectations for earnings are currently way too optimistic given the direction the economy is going. A major financial crash will likely hit by mid-June, Harry Dent, economist and author of several best-selling books, told the David Lynn Report recently. Dent, who has a history of making controversial predictions, believes that the current market bubble will burst and result in a financial meltdown. The bubble is a result of the U.S. Federal Reserve's loose monetary policy, which has artificially inflated the stock market, according to Dent. He expects the S&P 500 to collapse by 86% in this crash, and the NASDAQ to plummet by 92%. The crypto market will go into a tailspin alongside the stocks, the economist warned, predicting that Bitcoin will tumble 95 to 96% from its November 2021 high. Bitcoin will fall from $69,000 to about $3,000 to $4,000, he said, adding that it's exactly that Amazon and the dot-coms did. Dent points to what he sees as overlapping crises as the reason for his pessimism. The pandemic shattered the global economy in many ways, leading to job losses and reducing consumer spending. Additionally, unprecedented inflation in most wealthy countries and supply chain disruptions have sparked serious concerns among investors and economists forcing them to realize that this is not a big correction. It is a major crash, one that you have not seen in your lifetime, and the one that even the millennials will not see a bigger crash than this, Dent added. According to The Economist, despite efforts by central banks and their declared war on recession, we keep falling back into the recession because the economy underneath is really weak and really needs to get rid of a lot of really bad debt and zombie companies, and the central banks won't let the economy do its thing. Dent cautioned about the third wave of the crisis coming, emphasizing that in his view, it's going to creep up on the Federal Reserve before they can reverse the tightening. We have not cleaned up the massive debts and overvaluations of the biggest financial assets bubble in everything. We have never had a financial asset bubble in everything like this. This bubble has not been allowed to burst and clear out its excesses, which we need to do. And I think we are into that process now, Dent concluded. The Economist expects a crash more like 1929 to 1932, referring to the Great Depression, stressing that this is his best forecast at this time.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference being in Japan with her counterparts from the group of seven G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. Last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing the best, to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. the U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes on other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all of the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion. Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry have concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined.
Israel has kept pounding the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in the southern part of the besieged Palestinian territory. It came after the Israeli military conducted airstrikes against the Gaza Strip, assassinating senior Islamic Jihad officials.
The Israeli occupation committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which led to the killing of children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. Our people and the resistance know how to respond to this great crime and make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza have fired rockets towards Israeli sites in retaliation for the regime's deadly air raids, hitting targets as far as Tel Aviv. Gaza's Joint Command of Palestinian Resistance Groups claimed responsibility for firing rockets at Israel, saying in a statement it had fired hundreds of rockets towards the occupied Palestinian territories, including Tel Aviv, in an operation codenamed Revenge of the Free. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has warned that Israel will pay the price for the killings. The Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den has warned the Tel Aviv regime of surprise and unprecedented retaliatory attacks after the assassination of high-profile resistance commanders in Israeli airstrikes. Iran, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, amongst many Muslim countries, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, condemned in separate statements the Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. High-profile commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement have been assassinated after Israeli military aircraft launched a series of targeted strikes on the Gaza Strip days after a fiery flare-up of violence set the besieged coastal area on edge. Alongside the assassinations, military compounds and a military position belonging to the Islamic Jihad were targeted as well. The Islamic Jihad resistance commanders in the strikes include Khalil Bahitini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Izzeddin, a spokesperson for the movement, and Jihad Al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council. Bahitini was the most senior operational commander in the Islamic Jihad and was responsible for the rocket fire towards occupied territories in the past month. Izzeddin was responsible for the communications between the movement and its branches in the West Bank and for transferring funds and coordinating resistance active in the occupied lands. Ghannam was one of the most senior and veteran operatives in Islamic Jihad and served at one point as the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the southern Gaza Strip.
This enemy is a criminal entity ever since it was created on the land of Palestine. It assassinated leaders in their homes with their families and children. They did not assassinate them in the battlefield, not in the streets or cars. They assassinated them while they were with their children and killed their children and women along with them.
Meanwhile, Israeli troops have shot dead two young Palestinian men during a military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Kabatia, the latest in a year-long spike of violence that shows no sign of abating. The Israeli military said it conducted a raid in the early hours of Wednesday on Kabatia, situated 6 kilometers south of Jenin. The Palestinian Ministry of Health identified the victims as 19-year-old Ahmed Jamal Asif and 24-year-old Warani Walid Katanat. Another Palestinian was injured in the assault. Witnesses said a large number of Israeli forces raided Kabatia and broke into several homes in the western neighborhood of the West Bank city. They violently searched the buildings and ransacked all properties before leaving. The Israeli forces then closed the main streets in the town while laying siege to a number of houses. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank so far this year.
The gun violence nightmare continues in the U.S. 8 people were shot and several others wounded by a gunman at a busy mall north of Dallas, Texas. The gunman, whom authorities said they believe acted alone, was killed by a police officer after he began firing outside of the mall. He was wearing tactical gear and carrying an AR-15-style rifle during the attack. One young eyewitness described the horrifying moments as the shooting unfolded, including the terrifying sounds of the gunfire, and she remains fearful that such an attack could reoccur.
When I heard it, it was like really loud. It kept going like, and what my dad heard, it was like a pling in a car. And then when we were running, the shots got closer to us, like really, really close. And I thought they were running towards us since we were all running around and there were more people running around us. I felt really scared because many people were running for their lives and some people didn't survive. Some got injured. I'm still feeling scared because it could happen to us at school. It could happen to us at another mall.
Reports say the social media accounts of the shooter contained hundreds of posts with racially or ethnically motivated content and violent far-right rhetoric. The reports say the Dallas attacker may have been linked to white supremacist or neo-Nazi groups. Texas Governor Greg Abbott called the shooting an unspeakable tragedy.
Texans are hurting today, and the people who are hurting the most, obviously, are the families of the victims. Families who've lost a loved one, families who have a loved one who is injured.
Abbott also said there has been a dramatic increase in the amount of anger and violence that's taking place in America. He said mental health problems are the root cause and should be answered. Mass shootings have become commonplace in the United States. Since the beginning of 2023, more than 200 mass shootings have taken place in the country. Credible estimates show that nearly 15,000 people have died this year in gun violence incidents. In the wake of yet another mass shooting, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to pass gun control bills.
Yesterday, an assailant in tactical gear armed with an AR-15-style assault weapon gunned down innocent people in a shopping mall, and not for the first time. Such an attack is too shocking to be so familiar. We need more action, faster, to save lives.
The Democratic president renewed calls for Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, as well as to enact universal background checks and end immunity for gun manufacturers. Biden, who has made similar pleas before, said members of Congress cannot continue to meet the gun violence epidemic with a shrug. However, there is little chance the narrowly divided House and Senate would pass such legislation, although polls show most Americans support background checks. The U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms, and that issue is a hot-button one for many Republicans who are backed by millions in donations from gun rights groups and manufacturers.
We are not anti-gun. We're not against the Second Amendment. You know, we believe that we must restore the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. There are other peer nations, high-income countries, that have high rates of gun ownership but low rates of gun violence. Those two things can coexist. What we have that no peer nation has is this wealthy, powerful special interest that's been allowed to write our nation's gun laws.
Firearms outnumber the population in the United States, where victims of gun violence are higher than any developed country.
One-of-a-kind, multi-billion-pound coronation is finally coming to an end. A three-day ceremony which saw King Charles III crowned along with his wife Camilla. More than 2,000 guests, including world leaders, aristocrats, and celebrities, all participated in the event. Tens of thousands of people flooded the streets in London to see King Charles III formally crowned. Thousands saw the king receiving a royal salute from members of the military in the gardens of Buckingham Palace following his coronation. The coronation of King Charles III in London's historic Westminster Abbey was the first in the United Kingdom for 7 decades. Heavy police presence overshadowed the wealthy event. The London Metropolitan Police deployed more than 11,000 officers for one of their biggest ever security operations for the day of the coronation. For many, the coronation of King Charles III was maybe a lifetime event full of joy and days-long festivities as tens of thousands turned out to catch a glimpse of the newly crowned King Charles and Queen Camilla, who rode in a state coach back to Buckingham Palace after Saturday services at Westminster Abbey. But not everyone who came to watch the multi-billion-pound ceremony was there to cheer Charles. Thousands of people poured onto the streets to protest against the antiquated monarchical system.
Not my king! Not my king! Not my king!
My king! Not my king! Not my king!
Because I don't believe in hereditary monarchy, and I think this is costing a huge amount of money when lots of people are struggling, and the economy is falling apart, and the public services are awful, and we need to invest in that and not in Charles and his big party.
London's Metropolitan Police said in total, over 60 arrests were made on Saturday for what it called offenses, including breach of the peace and conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. Those detained include leader of an anti-monarchist group, The Republic. Graham Smith criticized the policing of the coronation as heavy-handed, saying the arrests were not about protecting people from harm, but about protecting the kingdom from embarrassment. The coronation of King Charles III comes as there is no budget revealed for the historic national state occasion. Some suggest that the ceremony could cost the nation between 50 to 100 million pounds. The government has so far refused to comment on the exact cost, making the amount of public funds spent on the festivities unknown. What is known, though, is that the multi-million pound coronation falls to taxpayers to foot the bill. Not only that, the coronation comes at a time when the country is gripped with protests and strikes in a dispute with the government over pay. Since last June, a huge number of workers have walked off their jobs, including teachers, civil servants, train and bus drivers,
border officials and university staff, nurses, ambulance drivers, and staff at swath of government agencies just to express that they can't literally make ends meet. With several waves of strikes sweeping the UK, the economy has been hit harder than initially expected. The UK inflation has experienced a 40-year high. That includes food prices, with some key ingredients seeing a steep rise of up to 50%, according to some detailed government data. The situation is to the extent where many people across the country are struggling to put food at the table. Furthermore, the UK financial woes have exacerbated the economic and social inequality there. That has prompted many to question the costly pomp and pageantry associated with the state-funded ceremony. A survey prior to the coronation showed that most of the British people simply did not want to pay for the costly event, and instead, they wanted the coronation to be funded by the royal family itself. Anti-monarchy activists said the cost is a slap in the face for millions of people who are struggling to meet their basic needs. Yet, they have to foot the bill in the form of taxes. Maybe that's why many across Britain see the monarchy as outdated and undemocratic, saying the coronation is a celebration of hereditary power and has no place in modern society. Maybe that's why many are worried that the coronation of a 74-year-old man will indirectly result in so many people going hungry.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, long lines have formed again next to the southern U.S. border wall in El Paso, Texas, as seen repeated in other parts of the southern U.S. border with Mexico, as migrants anticipated the end of a policy that has allowed immigration agents to quickly expel them from the United States. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. A Texas bill creating a state-run border protection unit has been brought back to life. HB 20 would create a state immigration unit to arrest, apprehend, or detain persons crossing the Texas-Mexico border unlawfully, something that has traditionally been the preserve of the U.S. federal government. The state-run push comes alongside a broader Republican attack on what they characterize as President Joe Biden's open borders policy. While the Biden administration has heavily promoted its new enforcement measures at the border and the Federal Border Patrol reports that encounters with migrants are a quarter below last year, Republicans, however, have described the situation at the U.S. southern border with Mexico in apocalyptic terms. Texas's Attorney General Ken Paxton wrote in a statement on Wednesday, 10th of May, that the brutal reality of Biden administration's agenda should shock the conscience of every American. President Biden's policies allow monstrous gang members, terrorists, human traffickers, drug dealers, and violent criminals into the country, and demonstrate that the president is willing to sacrifice American lives for his open borders agenda. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton added. Paxton's comments came just before the expiration on Friday night of Title 42, a Trump-era piece of legislation that has been used 2.8 million times since March of 2020 to expel asylum seekers from the United States. On Thursday, 11th of May, the House of Representatives voted to pass HB 2, a sweeping bill that, among a great deal else, makes asylum applications more stringent, restarts construction of a Trump-era border wall, and reopens immigration prisons closed by the Biden administration. Another clause of the national bill would see unaccompanied children and minors safely and expeditiously returned to their country of origin. But with that bill facing near certain death in the U.S. Senate and a President Biden veto, Texas is going it alone with House Bill 20 or HB 20 in a move that risks confrontation with the federal government should it pass. The bill has immigration advocates seeing a dire threat of their own. House Bill 20 or HB 20 is the most dangerous piece of border legislation we've seen, the Texas Civil Rights Project wrote in an April bill summary. The Texas bill faces a narrow window to passage. Democrats nearly scuttled it on procedural grounds last week, but Republicans successfully resurrected it this week, the Texas Tribune has reported. The new unit would be authorized to act only in the overwhelmingly Hispanic counties of the Texas-Mexico border, where they would be allowed to arrest, apprehend, or detain persons unlawfully crossing the Texas-Mexico border, and deter persons from attempting to cross the border unlawfully. The bill would also give the state new legal powers that prosecutors could use against migrants. It sets up a Texas-only version of Title 42. Also, it makes it a felony crime for anyone to knowingly trespass on private land while entering the state, which effectively criminalizes entering the state of Texas outside a port of entry, according to the Texas Civil Rights Project. This makes an offense that used to be a misdemeanor into a felony on par with kidnapping. The website of American newspaper, the Texas Tribune, has also covered this story and tells us more. As the clock ticked down to the end of a policy used to expel migrants from the United States nearly 3 million times over the past 3 years, the lines formed again on a patch of American soil between the Rio Grande and the border wall in southern United States. Hundreds of migrants, men, women, and children, stood in ragged lines waiting near a gate in the wall for their return to pass through. They were watched by Border Patrol agents and National Guard members in fatigues. For a moment, no one moved. A group of four Venezuelan men with a boy and a Colombian couple with their 2-year-old son waded across the shallow river and were turned back by National Border Guard. The migrants said the soldiers told them the border was closed and they should go to another area 5 miles east where agents may let them pass. The public health emergency order known as Title 42, which has been largely used as an immigration enforcement policy to quickly expel migrants from the United States, including asylum seekers trying to enter the United States, ended late on Thursday night, 11th of May. In preparation, U.S. federal, state and border officials across the roughly 2,000 miles of U.S.-Mexico border have implemented a series of policies to prepare for what they fear will be a chaotic crisis as thousands of migrants who have been forced to wait in Mexican border cities make a crucial decision. Follow the Biden administration's new rules and make an appointment to request asylum or try their luck crossing the U.S. border with Mexico en masse. In southern Texas, video footage from journalists on Wednesday, 10th of May, showed hundreds of immigrants gathering on the banks of the Rio Grande near Brownsville, Texas. In neighboring Hidalgo County, County Judge Richard Cortez issued a seven-day disaster declaration on Thursday. I have received credible information from officials with Customs and Border Protection that large groups of migrants are probing our international border in search of crossing points, he said. I have decided to declare this emergency as a first step in securing all available state and federal resources to ensure the health and safety of our residents. El Paso, Laredo, and Brownsville, Texas have previously declared state of emergencies. On Wednesday, 10th of May, El Paso city officials converted two vacant middle schools into migrant shelters using federal money. After Thursday, 11th of May, immigration agents will seek to deport migrants who attempt to enter the country without first having set up an appointment to enter the United States through a port of entry, using a government cell phone app known as CBP One. Migrants also have the option of applying for asylum at one of the new processing centers in Guatemala or in Colombia, which will give successful applicants the option to legally enter Canada, Spain, or the United States of America. Starting tonight, people who arrive at the border without using a lawful pathway will be presumed ineligible for asylum, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a statement late on Thursday, 11th of May. The border is not open. People who do not use available lawful pathways to enter the United States now face tougher consequences, including a minimum 5-year ban on re-entry and political criminal prosecution. A couple of hours before Title 42 was set to end, a federal judge in Florida blocked the Biden administration from carrying out a key part of its plan, paroling migrants into the country without a formal notice to appear in a court of law. The temporary restraining order came in response to a lawsuit by Florida's Attorney General. Border officials used parole during the Trump administration and under previous administrations. When the deadline came at 9:59 p.m. local time in El Paso, Texas, hundreds of migrants were still in line at the border wall gate, waiting for Border Patrol agents to apprehend them. Men stood in one line, women and children stood in another. Wherever agents took a small group of them through the gate, the migrants applauded and cheered. Earlier on Thursday, 11th of May, at a migrant camp in Ciudad Juarez, across the river from El Paso, Texas, Venezuelan migrant Richard Arcia, a 23-year-old, said he'll continue trying to use the app until he can get an asylum appointment. If he's successful, he said, he plans to go to New Jersey, where he has family members.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. The freedom of Islam is freedom. Islam does not confine us in the framework of materialism. You were created to remain, not to perish. Shia Creeds 47. We will not stop existing. As the Persian poet Rumi says, the time has arrived to pass away and to search. Every created thing shall perish except his face. Dying is not the end. Dying is the beginning of a new stage. In fact, the main stage. When you look at it this way, that's when you can soar. And your movement, your progress, and your transcendence will no longer be limited. This is freedom. All the freedoms in life, including personal freedom, freedom of opinion, being freed from the captivity of immobility, stagnation, lethargy, and all kinds of backwardness, meaningless prejudices, and freedom from the captivity of the superpowers and dictators are all the results of the foundations of Islamic freedom.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You need to think about these and work on them. The solution is not for me to come and talk to you about these things for half an hour, for instance. You need to work on these yourselves. You need to think. You need to read books. Or consider the concept of awaiting the reappearance of Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajuh sharif. This awaiting the Saviour is one of the important foundations of our intellectual and religious principles. Awaiting the Saviour means that all difficulties can be eliminated and removed. This does not mean one should merely sit around and wait. Rather, you need to be alert. In the story of Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, his mother was told, "We will return him to you and make him one of the messengers." The Holy Quran, Surah 28, verse 7. "We will return this child to you, make him one of the messengers, and he will save you." This strengthened the Israelites. The Israelites practiced resistance in Egypt under Pharaoh for many years. Of course, they ruined everything later on, but they resisted for many years. It was this resistance that brought Moses to them. He started his movement and they followed him. This led to the destruction of Pharaoh and his system.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio.